Welcome to the CyberCube podcast. This episode is part of our Cyber Insight series, where we deep dive into one of our reports. Today we'll be talking about the joint report that CyberCube and Marsh McLennan have published called Improve Loss Ratios with CyberCube's Predictive Analytics. I'm your host, Rihanna Mistry, Content Specialist at CyberCube, and I'm joined by John Anderson, CyberCube's Principal Product Manager, and Rush Karubi, Senior Cyber Modeler at Marsh McLennan. Could you both introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm John Anderson. I'm a product manager and product owner at CyberCube, and I oversee a suite of underwriting products. I've been at the company for over 6 years now, and before joining, I previously worked as a cyber underwriter in the insurance market.
Hi, I'm Rush Karubi. I'm a senior cyber modeler at the Marsh McLennan Cyber Risk Intelligence Center. I specialize in analyzing external cyber hygiene and threat actor data from various sources with a goal of enhancing our in-house cyber attritional loss model. And over the past 8 years, I've applied data science techniques in cyber risk, meteorology, and satellite remote sensing technology. I hold undergraduate degrees in economics and statistics, and I have a background in business intelligence and analytics.
Great, thank you. Now, before we get into the details, John, could you give us some context for the joint report that CyberCube and Marsh published?
Yeah, certainly. So we recently co-authored this report as we wanted to work together to study the efficacy of CyberCube's various cyber risk signals and scores, and wanted to see together how do these signals and scores stack up against real-life insurance claims. And Marsh had been doing this previously with others in the market and thought this would be a great opportunity for us to collaborate together and identify which factors matter most, see how correlated CyberCube's various factors were, and present some interesting findings that the market could use and take with them as they think about which factors matter most for them.
And Rush, in terms of what Marsh hoped to achieve with these studies, what's your perspective?
Well, in one sentence, we're looking for the best data sets that are correlated with cyber risk. There's so many cybersecurity vendors out there, and we have no shortage of them banging or knocking politely on the door and asking us to sign up. And they give anecdotal examples of how their data is the best. They were able to find a notification or some sense of something happening with a cyber signal in their data sets ahead of a breach. And they share that information with us. But we are looking for something that's beyond anecdotal. We're trying to look for something that could be applied broad brush. If we have a portfolio of thousands of organizations, can the same data still stack up in the same level of correlation and or predictability?
John, I know you understand that cyber data conundrum as well. Could you speak to that a bit more?
So cyber data can be really tough to work with. We hear our customers struggling to find insight from raw findings all the time. And for the products I work on, we hear how challenging it can be to get underwriters to adopt metrics, that really being one of the top things they're after. For adopting these metrics, we recognize that you really need them to, first of all, be understandable and digestible. These cyber metrics can be super technical and really need to be distilled down to a level that folks can understand, right? Those who are actually looking at them and putting them into practice, it has to be put into terms they can work with. The second thing we see that they really need to have in order to be adopted is they need to be novel, right? Unique and predictive. These have to be something that you don't necessarily get from a pen and paper application. And critically, they have to be highly correlated to claims data, right? And incident data and notification of claims in order for people to want to pay attention to it. And lastly, we really see that these need to fit into our clients' workflow, making sure they have the right data at the right time to make a decision. I'm curious, Rush, what do you see with Marsh's enterprise clients? What are the challenges you see there?
I think it's more or less the same thing. It's very granular. In some of these data sets that we've received from other vendors, it's counts of observations on a very granular level of, say, every hour over a period of the last 5 years, if that's the kind of period we want to look at and take a deep dive and try to find correlation with that kind of data. But at the same time, you want to be able to summarize all those findings in a clean slide deck or some actionable finding that a CISO can use with their board of executives. And also, even with some individual organizations, especially if you think about the Fortune 1000 organizations, they've got large IP address footprints. And so just diving deep into that, you sort of almost like boiling the ocean when you're trying to find insights there. And it's not very actionable to use at that point. And so if you're trying to review thousands of those data points, you need to be able to figure out a process to distill that into metrics that are known and that change with time and that are reactive. And so that's one of the challenges, or at least many of the challenges we find with looking at raw data as is.
Yeah, glad you took that angle, Rush. I was actually thinking something very similar, which is you are boiling the ocean. I like the way you put that. The cyber threat landscape is highly dynamic and it's keeping all of us on our toes. There are new vulnerabilities being discovered daily, and a massive number of these entry vectors and threats and other risk factors that organizations may want to be aware of. This problem space attracts a lot of people, as well as a lot of different data points, right, that can be used to understand. You're saying there's millions of these data points. Yeah, and at the confluence of all these factors, there's just an overabundance of cyber metrics out there to look at. And when you try to look at the raw data, just as it is, it's going to be for anyone in the insurance industry just as impossible for them to make sense of all these different data points as it is for the organization, right, where it's their data.
Correct.
They have even more that they're looking at. And even to get a specific example, right, if you're even trying to distill it down and say, okay, we're going to try to focus on raw CVEs and just look at all of them, right, even that will be overwhelming. And eventually you'll find yourself in a game where you can identify certain high-risk CVEs, you can try to mitigate those CVEs or patch them and take care of them. But in doing so, you may end up neglecting some of the bigger trends that are seen and are really taken care of with a more necessary holistic evaluation. Cybersecurity defense is not won in a game of whack-a-mole, right? Rather, it's fortified by taking a more holistic look, a more holistic analysis of all the different factors, and then determining where the greatest threat lies and like where collectively the organization needs to focus on. At CyberCube, we're really interested in distilling these insights down. So in addition to doing this study with Marsh, we tend to study our signals and scores all the time. We've done our own analysis. We've done claim studies with other insurance carriers and their data. And we really want to understand how we can make these metrics more predictive. We recognize that underwriters don't have time to stay abreast of every minute detail in the threat landscape. And they can be most effective in their jobs when they're trusting and using metrics that are truly predictive of an insurance loss or incident. We're going through and doing a lot of that heavy legwork. We're going to stay on top of the trends. We're going to study the different risk factors, and we're going to present those factors that matter most, again, in that digestible format. Rush, I wanted to dive in a little bit more on the study we did together. Could you give a bit more detail about this study, maybe more on a high-level approach to how we went about it?
Sure, John. Very basically, there's what we call a correlation coefficient. That's the premise of the entire study. And in simple terms, you can think of age and, say, height. Naturally, we think of those two things as being correlated, meaning when you grow older, your height tends to be increased, especially as a young one to an adult. And so that's the kind of association you're trying to look at in these kinds of studies. Specifically with this one, we're looking for an inverse relationship. We have the signals that you've pointed out, John, that you've got the score of 90 or higher. But at the same time, the inverse relationship we're looking for is that that score of 90 means you're less likely to experience a breach or a cyber event. And so that's what the entire correlation study is built on. And the correlation coefficient is just a number telling you how strong that inverse relationship is. And we did this for all signals within the study, ranking them from the most important to the least important.
And Rush, did any of the signals that you were looking at or any of the scores, any of them surprise you in going through this study?
Yeah. So Oh, I guess surprised because I've had it before and I was just surprised to see it confirmed. And this was specifically the email security misconfigurations and the domain misconfigurations. So somewhere along the lines, we've been hearing how cyber hygiene is important. You know, the anecdotal, you should floss your teeth before you go to bed. That will keep cavities away. It's not as exciting to hear that, but that's the truth. And it was interesting to see that, yeah, if you're not configuring your internal assets properly, as evidenced by these two signals, then you're le more likely to experience breaches. And I think this is a bigger problem, not just in these two signals, but what we probably are seeing elsewhere, where maybe it is informing organizational culture, that organizations that tend to fix things or have things in a properly configured way are less likely to experience this large stake cyber events that we're often seeing on the news. And so I think that was the biggest surprise for me from the study, or at least it confirmed something that I had.
So just to follow up on that, Rush, you would say that what came out of the study, you kind of expected that. Did you go into it trying to confirm a hunch that you had, or was there a different approach?
So we always try to take an unbiased view. We've done a lot of these studies in the past, and always the hope is there's some signal in the data because this is a vendor or other vendors that are being used within the whole entire insurance landscape. And so you don't want people to be using wrong data, right? We always want to make sure that everybody is at least getting some value from what a lot of these vendors provide. So we go in it hoping that there's a signal, but we're not trying to bias the results or come up with a perspective that will inform us when you're trying to analyze what we see. And so we just try to let the statistics speak for themselves, but at the same time, we are controlling for various variables, which I'll probably mention later on, and make sure that we are not making spurious assumptions or spurious analysis interpretations in whatever we see, and that all our answers are answered by the vendor who gave us the data, because there's also a lot of back and forth between us and the vendor, because we treat this as a blind test. They don't see the claims data, and we don't necessarily see how the sausage is made. And so it needs us to sort of meet in the middle and say, while we can't necessarily share both those two aspects, these are the assumptions going in when we collect data. That's on the vendor side. And then on the claim side, we can tell them, hey, this data, there might be a lag because claims don't come instantaneously. So we can't tell you when this was reported, but we can tell you the period or the window of time that we expected your data to be relevant to what we are seeing. So it's those aspects that come in. But at the same time, yeah, to answer your question, we try not to take a biased view when we start these studies, and we just hope that the data will speak for itself.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, Rush. I think we tend to approach this the same way ourselves. So when we're trying to study our signals, we're trying to think about how some of these individual risk factors, work together in addition to what they look like in isolation. We're trying not to bias it too much, and we want the data to speak for itself. In doing so, you had called out a specific signal, which I think is interesting. So you're seeing it across many of these studies that you've done. And while you weren't trying to bias it and be looking out for it, it was showing up on its own. Similarly, I'm guessing there are a bunch of other signals where, maybe you were expecting to see them across vendors and they didn't show up. And it seems to be indicating that not all of these signals are created equal. They're not all looking for the same things. They don't all have the same firing rules in what they're trying to measure. So you can see variability across different companies that are building these risk factors. And paying attention to what vendors are offering matters because you need to know what is going into the sausage at some point. And are they looking at the right things? Are what they are looking at highly correlated?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also there's just non-standard ways, because if you're talking about how there's remedial actions for CVEs and how you collect that data, there's disagreement in terms of how to do that. And so that disagreement is likely to bubble up to the surface in terms of more refined signals that are presented to a user. And so that definitely is different across the board.
Yeah, that's a great example of one signal that there's certain to be differentiation amongst those that try to present something on it.
Since publishing the study, what would you both say has been the impact? John, I'll start with you. What would you say has come out of it, and what have you heard from the industry about it?
So I think I've referred to this previously, but to just restate, this study really helps illuminate which risk factors matter with real-life claims. So whether you're a busy insurance underwriter trying to quickly evaluate a risk, or even an enterprise trying to come to terms with your own exposure, what's at stake and how much risk you should be transferring off your balance sheet, these signals have a big impact. I think what we've been seeing as we're walking through our various analytics with clients and prospects is, hey, understanding how these signals are correlated matters. Like, here's some ways we've been looking at this, and it's really been opening up the conversation and opening up some market participants' eyes in terms of what they should be focusing on and what matters, and getting them excited to look a little bit deeper about the factors that they're currently looking at and the factors that they could explore a bit more. And I think it's helping to push the insurance industry forward and, starting to adopt more of these advanced metrics and analytics into their workflow.
Rush, would you say you're experiencing the same or a different perspective?
I guess more or less, maybe where I see this, and this might be a recurring theme as we go on, is that a lot of the insurance industry focuses on industry and revenue. Those are the biggest drivers of cyber risk loss. It's how they think about diversifying and how to figure out new business and whatnot. So the real world impact from the study is more like, hey, beyond revenue and industry, there are other things, the cyber things that make sense that are still correlated with claims, and you could use them to inform your decision making, whether that's an insurer trying to diversify their book, or whether that's an organization that feels maybe because of the industry they're in, they've probably been categorized as a high risk. It's very easy to think about all those hospitals and the ransomware attacks that they experience, and people seeing healthcare in general not being a very good industry per se because of all those cyber events that had happened previously. So you're almost trying to put yourself differently and say, no, we have a robust cyber program in our organization. We've checked all the boxes here. And as you can see, these are the top 10 things in terms of cyber signals that are going to make you more likely to experience a breach or not. And so focusing on that narrative and making sure that they have something tangible to show when they use those cyber signals as a reference is helpful. Because I think people can rule out a risk just because of the industry or revenue class that it belongs to.
So yeah, you mentioned clients using these signals and how it's helping them. Are there any other practical examples of how these analytics and the study itself are helping your clients?
So I can think of one client semi-recently who, right off the bat, they wanted to know, how do I stack up to my peers? So we've given them cyber signals and they're like, okay, but what about my peers? And I think that's what they use as a barometer to decide what type of cybersecurity investments to make. So internally, we've taken some of these signals in from other places and we've created a frequency modifier that could nudge up or down how likely or less likely to experience cyber events that a company will have. And so we can plug in the numbers for that organization and say, yeah, you're 2 times or 3 times more likely to experience an event, or 0.5 times less likely to experience an event. So we use that as a way to inform them more holistically of what they're doing or how they're doing in comparison to their peers, rather than just saying, okay, let's take 10 clients and take the average score. I mean, I don't think that gives you enough because you're missing that piece of how likely is that score correlated to claims occurrence. And so we're trying to bridge those two parts together, and we're trying to give them a more holistic picture and still give them one number that they can focus on that changes over time. And they can use that as a metric to see if they're improving or not.
Yeah, I would add benchmarking, Rush, is really critical with any of this, right? Any of us can come up with a score or a top level factor, and we can say, hey, it's really predictive, but the context of it matters, doesn't it? You want to know, how does this impact other like peers? How does this company, whether it's your client that you're working with, how do they stack up to other peer clients that you might be aware of? And then from what I'm seeing on the underwriting side, underwriters are all about this cognitive ability to compare and contrast what one account looks like relative to another, right? What one deal looks like relative to another deal, and weighing in some of the different factors. So I think it's really important to put all these factors into that context, see how a company stacks up to its peers, and understand, as you call out, is that getting better or worse over time? Having a bit of a trend analysis, being able to set some type of standard and benchmark that can improve over time or possibly degrade over time. And you'd want to know that as well. You want to know how it's moving. And in some ways, it's good to have these factors that are dynamic. But in other ways, you know, you may hope that they're a little bit more stable so that you can do some of this necessary comparison and benchmarking and trend analysis. In fact, when we see underwriters use some of our different signals and scores, we see them coming across in a bunch of different ways, right? And I think it all comes down to their appetite of what they're trying to do, what they're trying to accomplish, and to an extent, what they've found to be most indicative or most predictive based on their own studies, based on some of the collaboration efforts that we have with folks like yourself and Marsh. And one of the top things we see is around risk triage. So trying to find accounts that are or are not worth further investigating, setting up some criteria, maybe based on how companies stack up to certain peer groups, right? Maybe we only want the cream of the crop, the best of the best in a certain segment that might be known to be higher risk. And then when certain factors are shown, making a decision off of that, or just having a quick rule that helps you quickly sift through all your accounts and know what you want to do. The next stage we've seen folks get involved in is something a bit more automated, where they're looking at all these different factors and figuring out where they matter. And once they find the ones that they think are a problem for their book, they identify and say, hey, I want our underwriting team to focus on these. And they're able to streamline that data into things like their rating model modifiers. They can streamline it into their underwriting write-ups and beyond, just getting these signals in the right place at the right time for faster decision-making and cutting through the noise even more into a workflow. And then, Rush, you had mentioned how you're incorporating these factors into loss modeling, if I'm not mistaken, before. And we also see clients trying to do this, right? They want to identify where they can modify the pricing. You know, from an underwriting perspective, it's modifying your scheduled mods, your debits and credits on the account, seeing which factors kind of corroborate your view of risk, where they diverge, and where you want to amend your base assumption.
So we've heard the underwriting and broker perspective. John, can you tell me how are portfolio managers and actuaries using this data to make more strategic decisions?
Yeah, being able to study these factors for your entire portfolio becomes really powerful, especially when you're trying to set up a benchmark and track over time, but also in terms of building a feedback loop for your portfolio, right? This is where real progress can be made. You want to study your entire portfolio, identify where the problem areas are, identify where the problem signals are and where they matter most, and then start keeping track. Start seeing where there's drift in your portfolio, or start seeing where there's even idiosyncratic behavior in your portfolio, right, that you want to watch out for. Being able to get a handle of these factors on a portfolio basis and feed them back into your frontline underwriting process becomes way more powerful because you can both monitor the change and affect the change, right? You can use it to help set strategy. You can use it to start weeding out those problem accounts in your portfolio and build that more resilient, bottom line driven portfolio that you want that will ultimately make you a sustainable market player.
And this is for either of you, but are there any specific portfolio use cases for enterprise clients or captives?
Yeah, I think the portfolio use case for an enterprise client is, you can imagine large organizations that have very easily 1,000+ vendors, and they depend on those vendors for their critical day-to-day businesses. And so you can imagine a situation where the systemic threats, whether it's this SharePoint vulnerability that was discovered the other day, or some other supply chain like vulnerability that can hit that, you know, we're not calling it a book of business, but call it a book of vendors. And so those large enterprises are wondering, can I experience business interruption because a lot of these vendors went offline because of one single event? And that's a very good, not necessarily traditional use case that people think of, but it is a portfolio use case for the large enterprise. And then conversely, captives behave like reinsurers, right? they might be beholden to a large enterprise company, but they also might be formed by multiple companies together. So you could think of captives that were formed as a result of 10 or more companies. And so that captive's responsibility is to review the cyber risk that it's likely to face if any of those 10 companies were to experience a cyber event, or in the example I just presented, if there's any systemic supply chain event that was going to occur. And so this is still a portfolio use case type that is useful for the captive. And so it is going through the same techniques that John pointed out, where you still want to be able to have point-in-time analysis of how those organizations are doing from the cyber signals. Are they going higher or lower? Are some organizations tracking to the bottom, or some are moving fast? And maybe there's learnings that could be transferred to the same organizations in the same captive list, just because there are probably more open communication channels there than if it was a reinsurance book where, I'm sure most clients and most organizations want to keep their cybersecurity programs tightly knit to the extent that they can. But maybe in a captive, there's probably more knowledge sharing just because there's the assurance that this captive is owned by the company and therefore they're likely to make even more commanding strategies.
John, anything to add there?
Yeah, I would say captives are certainly an interesting one. I think another less traditional structure that we've seen this be quite powerful as well is risk pools. So captives can operate risk pools as well, but we've seen quite a bit of interest from some seemingly homogenous risk groups that are trying to get an understanding of where the idiosyncrasies are. They've identified their risk can be quite similar, and that can matter certainly from a catastrophic perspective. So they really want to get a handle on those scenarios that can impact the entire portfolio all at once. But beyond those, they also want to know, well, what are the factors, right? What are the specific elements that can help all of the members get ahead because they share that more homogeneous risk and like threat landscape?
So I just want to shift to looking at the future. Rush, what's next for building on these types of analytics? Are there things that you're eager to explore and that you see developing over the next few years?
Yeah, so as far as the study is concerned, you'll notice it was purely a single variable analysis type study. So we were looking at one cyber signal at a time and sort of rank ordering what are the most important. Obviously, the next step there is looking at interactions between those signals. At the same time, you want to know what's the joint effect of multiple signals. So I've alluded to that previously, where I talked about in our modeling, we use the cyber signals and we look at it from that multivariable construct. So obviously, that's a step farther for the study, seeing if there's interactions that were not intuitive before. In terms of the future and what will be interesting to work on, I think this supply chain problem, we don't really necessarily have a good framework for it just yet. I mean, we're in the early stages. We are identifying technology dependencies that are used by multiple companies, if not others that are concentrated maybe by an industry sector or whatnot. And therefore, that's potential for risk there. If that particular technology dependency goes down, an event happens. And I already talked about the SharePoint vulnerability that just happened recently. I think that's where the struggle is. And whoever comes up with a robust framework there is going to be repaid in full, just because we're just being able to identify it, but being able to have a strong framework and use it in our modeling beyond what we are doing today is the next frontier.
John, I'd be interested to hear your perspective on this, because of course at CyberCube we have solutions like Spoff Intelligence, which identifies single points of failure, as well as other analytics that serve the entire insurance ecosystem. So as we wrap up, how do you see the advancements of these kinds of analytics evolving?
Yeah, that is certainly an interesting area for us as well. It's something that we continue to explore and investigate and try to understand, what factors matter from the digital supply chain and how can we generate these health metrics around the digital supply chain again in ways that people can actually use. We were talking before about there being a sea of data with vulnerabilities. When you talk about digital supply chain and technological dependencies, like that is an enormous sea unto itself, if not an ocean, right? And being able to correlate all these different factors is a really interesting problem and one we think that's important to study. I also wanted to highlight, and Rush, it's as though you took some of my thoughts out of my mind, but studying more from a multivariate impact perspective, right? Going from just one signal at a time to seeing how the signals work together in combination. I see a lot of advancements in doing that as well. It's something we've already begun. So we feed our signals into predictive models, and those predictive models then inform our scores and our loss modeling capability. But continuing to identify how these signals work together, I think, is certainly a continuing area and one we want to keep exploring. Also, as we're seeing this growing use of large language models, right, moving beyond some of the more generic NLP technology and going to LLMs, I think there's great opportunity for even more advanced signals than what already exists today. And there's going to be more advanced ways to gather more insights, gather more incidents, and use all of this data and present it in more novel and interesting ways, right? So much of what we've been talking about has been, how do you study these factors that can be used? But then putting them into practice is really where I think we see an evolution of the market, and really excited to be a part of it. And the work that CyberCube's doing is certainly trying to be at the forefront as we help our clients and customers and everyone in the cyber reinsurance space navigate this field.
Thank you for listening to the CyberCube podcast, where we break down cyber risk, insurance, and everything in between. If you enjoyed today's conversation, make sure to subscribe on your preferred listening platform and tune in for the next episode. You can read the full report on our website, www.cybercube.com, where you can also get in touch with us if you'd like to learn more. Until next time, stay informed, stay resilient, and keep shaping the future of cyber insurance.